Ah, you know that sound? I think it's a sandhill crane. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Our guest next is Rich Belfus. He is the president and CEO of the International Crane Foundation. So we'll be talking with him about the foundation's effort to conserve cranes around the world. And their job has certainly become harder because of the pandemic. So we'll talk with him about that. And of course, take your questions about cranes. Have you spotted any whooping cranes this spring? What would you like to know about volunteering with the Crane Foundation? You can join in at 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Rich Belfus, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be on. Thanks.
It's great to have you with us. For those who aren't familiar with the International Crane Foundation, give us a little history and background on that organization.
You bet. So the International Crane Foundation was founded back in 1973, so we've been around for quite a while, and you just heard from my wife, Katie, not long ago about Wisconsin Wetlands, and they are just a little bit older than us, but we're some of the older conservation groups in the state. And we've been at it for quite a while. We work locally and globally, so we have many people in Wisconsin know us from our headquarters and our crane exhibits up in Baraboo, Wisconsin, about an hour or so north from where we are in Madison here. And we also work around the world in crane conservation. Most of the really endangered cranes of the world are over in Africa and Asia, so we have pretty big programs over there. But back here at home, very focused on the whooping cranes and the recovery of the whooping crane to the eastern U.S., especially here, and helping monitor and watch the delightful recovery of sandhills that have come back so strongly over the last 100 years here in Wisconsin and around the Midwest as well.
Yeah.
So we focus a lot on cranes, and we focus especially on their habitat requirements, wetlands and grasslands and agricultural areas that they depend on.
How many species of cranes exist?
There are 15 worldwide. We have the most abundant crane, the sandhill, here in the U.S., and we have the rarest crane in the world, our whooping cranes. Here in the U.S., there's just about 500 in the wild in the original flock out west, and the other 13 are overseas. Like I said, Asia, Africa, and there's one crane species that's only down in Australia.
Yeah. Man, only 500.
Yeah.
Oh boy. And, you know, you mentioned these programs around the world. I expect COVID-19 has affected your programs pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, it has in so many ways. You know, when the COVID crisis first broke out in China, we have big programs in China. We're registered there with an office in Beijing. We do a lot of conservation work in China. And so some of our staff were shut down as of January for months, and it was very restrictive there. People couldn't go out at all. We couldn't do field work this season. So I sort of knew early on, you know, oh boy, when this comes here, and assuming it does come over to the U.S. eventually, we need to be prepared to be down for a long time. And so I've sort of been coaching our staff from the get-go that we should be looking at this in a marathon mode. And, of course, that's what we're all living in now, you know, a couple of months of shutdown. And then our colleagues in Africa, we do quite a bit of work in Africa, and we had to shut down very quickly in Africa because we were worried about our own staff going out with these very poor communities that we work with and risking passing the virus to them. So it became complicated getting our programs at least temporarily shut down and then figuring out how to reopen in a way that we don't, especially we don't affect any of the most vulnerable communities that we work with out there. So.
Yeah. What are you doing to protect volunteers?
Well, we were very careful, certainly with our staff and volunteers, in terms of social distancing and using masks and all. We only recently resumed some field work as some of the restrictions in the state lessened up, and the same in some of the other places that we work. As the restrictions lessen a little, then we're getting back out in the field. But, you know, we do things like staff drive separately, so we don't, you know, do some of the things that we used to do. We have staff go out to the sites and stay safe and stay separate and all. But we're able to get quite a few people out now and get some things done, including monitoring our whoopers and sandhills that have come back to the state to breed this spring. So that's been fun. And, you know, step by step, we're getting back out. Our office has been mostly shut down, but we've certainly had to have our core staff there taking care of our captive cranes. We've got more than 100 cranes for our displays and for a sort of a genetic bank up at the Crane Foundation. And so we've had people out taking care of those birds throughout and making sure that they're healthy as well. So it's been a big juggle of a lot of activities, keeping our staff safe, of course, keeping our cranes safe too. So.
And I imagine that you can learn a lot from COVID about crisis management for big conservation challenges like endangered cranes.
You know, there's so much to learn from this crisis because, you know, some of the big lessons for any global crisis we're dealing with, whether it's, you know, loss of biodiversity or climate change or other issues is, you know, if you wait too long to act, it gets a lot more costly and a lot more difficult to take action then and shut it down. And we're always encouraging, you know, the best time. We don't want to watch things disappear before we take action on biodiversity, and we don't want to see irreversible changes on our landscape before we take action on climate change. So we really think there's important lessons about taking swift action. And, of course, we want to avoid the kind of terrible shutdown that we've had to have over COVID by being more proactive on these conservation measures and finding ways to take action early so that the actions aren't so severe later. So I think that's been a really big lesson to me. And, you know, another big one, I think, is that, you know, as we're hearing here, the poor communities are the most vulnerable to all these crises. And we need to especially make sure whatever solutions that we put in place to deal with these crises are not leaving behind the people that are most vulnerable, you know, the least able to deal with changes and with the economic hardship and everything else. So it's very challenging, but I think those lessons from a conservation viewpoint are very, very important.
Rich Belfis, our guest president and CEO of the International Crane Foundation. Questions or comments for him, join in at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Mark emailed in to ask you to talk about the crane event at the International Crane Foundation headquarters in June. Is it happening? If so, what would it look like?
Well, sadly, the grand opening in June is not happening. Just a little background on that. We were closed last year, the year before all of this big crisis outbreak, to do this beautiful remodel of our site, and it's going to be fantastic. We have a brand new visitor center, and we have 10 new exhibits for the cranes. They're bigger and more open. They all have beautiful wetlands in them, and we're really excited to reopen our site and get the public back out there. We were planning a reopening in late June, but you know, we don't see that being possible this year because of the shutdown, or at least this June. I'll say there's a chance maybe we'll be able to do it in the fall. What we will most likely do is some sort of soft opening this year and a bigger to-do next year, but we'll certainly keep people posted on our website and with some mailings about how that's progressing. But sadly, our June event won't happen. We were certainly hoping to have hundreds and hundreds of people on our site, and we don't see that as likely in a month from now. But we'll get there. we are so excited to roll out our new site, and you know, it's hard to believe again that we were already self shut down a whole year before we all became shut down. But we'll get back out there, and we want to get people back on our prairies all around the foundation and out to see these new exhibits. So the soonest we can do that safely, we will. Yeah.
Yeah, really excited about that because I really enjoyed the headquarters and the site before all of the work, and so I've been excited to see what the result of all this new work is going to be. I bet a lot of people are.
Yeah, it's fun. You know, it's such a great opportunity. You know, as I mentioned before, we work all over the world, and most people that come to the foundation no sandhill cranes, or maybe we're lucky enough to see a whooper in the wild here in Wisconsin or out west, and so they have a little sense of the world of cranes from seeing them locally. But we try to use our exhibits to connect people to all the cranes of the world, and you can see, you know, cranes from Africa and from India and Vietnam and different places, and learn about our programs in those places. And it's fun to draw those connections from the cranes to the places and the people that we work with around the world. And so we try to be a gateway that way. So, yeah.
How did the headquarters wind up in Baraboo, by the way?
The foundation was basically the dream of two graduate students, George Archibald, who still lives in Baraboo, and Ron Sowie. Ron Sowie passed away about 30 years ago, but the two of them were students at Cornell and had been doing their graduate work on captive cranes, in addition to some work on wild cranes, and they were looking for a place to set up to study captive birds when their graduate work wound up. And Ron Sowie had parents in Baraboo, and basically the parents offered part of their horse farm to set up shop there. It was just a little down the road from where we are today, just a couple of miles from where we are today. But it was sort of a fluke in a way that we started out in Baraboo. But you know, the location is fantastic for us because we work with so many conservation groups that are out on the coasts, in New York and in Washington, D.C. and so on. And I think being in a rural landscape like Baraboo is fantastic for us. You know, we do conservation in rural areas, and it keeps us connected to the farms and the rural lands where cranes really are. I think even though it was kind of a fluke in a way that we ended up in Baraboo, I think it's perfect for what we are as an organization. So.
Cheryl in Eau Claire has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Cheryl.
Ooh, hello there. I live out in the country in Eau Claire, and we have a road dividing two ponds. And last year, one of the cranes, sandhill cranes, which I just love the sounds in the morning, one of them was killed. And this year I noticed there's another couple and then this odd one out. Would they be, and they were together this time, would they form a new family, or would that one odd man out sort of keep coming back? Do they mate for life, or how does that work?
Well, great question. We always say the cranes mate for life with a little star next to that and say, unless something else comes up. So the cranes can mate for life when they, you know, successfully have chicks every year after year. They'll often stay together as couples for a very long time. But if a mate is killed, like in your situation, they will repair. Or sometimes when they're just not successful as a pair for several years and for whatever reason not producing chicks, they might also repair. So I think there's a very good chance your birds there will repair have a new mate and have chicks again. So usually that's the situation, and we certainly hope for that there. So.
Yeah, we sure do. And we can talk some more about if that may be the same crane coming back, that odd man out. We'll find out some more about that, and we'll certainly be answering your questions about cranes with Rich Belfus, President and CEO of the International Crane Foundation. You'll be with us till 12:30. We'll take a quick look now at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with Rich Belfus. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Talking cranes today on the Ideas Network, Larry Mueller here, and certainly discussing the efforts of the International Crane Foundation to reestablish crane populations. Our guest is the foundation president of the International Crane Foundation, Rich Belfus. Are you seeing more sandhills in your area? What questions do you have about whooping cranes? You can join in, maybe a good experience to share, or a bad one. Join in the conversation at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Rich, Cheryl had asked a couple of questions. One of the questions she asked related to a crane losing its mate, but then a single crane came back with another pair to her area, and she's wondering if it might be the same crane. Would they come back to the same area?
Yeah, they do. They often do return to the same area, and there are some funny kind of trios out there on the landscape that we see sometimes. Usually, when the parents finish their breeding season with new chicks and they migrate south for the winter and they come back up, they usually kick out their chicks, their youngsters who are about a year old at that time. They usually kick them out and they have to go off and find new territories, and usually they roam about for a couple of years and then sort of settle down. We call it their teenage years, when they get to roam around a little bit and then they settle down on new sites. So usually if there's another bird with the pair, it's not their youngster from the year before. It's another bird that's grouped up with them. But we see all kinds of interesting things going out there, going out on the landscape. And so you never know. You never know what's going on in their minds on some of these things. But we have seen trios out there, and especially if there are times when a mate will get bumped out and another bird will move in. So,
Kenneth called. He couldn't stay online, but wondering, are all the cranes back in Wisconsin? They thought they saw a whooping crane, but maybe they just dreamed it.
Yeah, whoopers are back. All of our whoopers pretty much are back in the state now. They're either for the birds that are paired up, they're either on nests still or have chicks. We know of at least five chicks now that have been hatched this year, and there's probably more. Our team has been getting out monitoring them and trying to figure out the status of all of the pairs out there. But we know of at least five chicks, and sort of fun news from those chicks, two of the five chicks are from new pairs that never nested before. So, and the other three are from pairs that have nested in past years. So, you know, as we try to bring this population back, that's exactly what we want to see, is that new pairs are forming and that slowly these birds are becoming, you know, what we call self-sustaining. They're able to produce chicks that eventually grow up and have their own chicks and keep the population going. So that's our goal of where we want to get. So, yeah, you can definitely find whoopers out there on the landscape. There are some still that can be seen at Nisida National Wildlife Refuge, and then some are just scattered out in the landscape of the sort of Central Sands area and a little bit south of there. So,
Mark in Ithaca has a question. Mark, hello. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Recently, I viewed a pair, a mating pair with, they actually had two little furry ball chicks right next to the highway in the Willow Creek bottom near Aubrey, and was just curious. In the past, when I saw mating pairs like that, I'd only see a single chick. So these had two chicks, and they were actually out with the parents pecking through the tilled soil, and was just curious how long the fostering goes on of the parents of those young chicks.
Ah, great. Great question. Sandhills often do have two chicks, and it's one of the reasons they've been a really successful crane species, is they frequently have two chicks. The whooping cranes are much more likely only to have one. Sometimes they'll have two, but it's a lot more rare for the whoopers, so their recovery, that's one of the reasons that their recovery is a lot slower. But, they will hatch their chicks right around now, you know, more or less. We've had chicks out for a few weeks now, but they hatch their chicks in the spring, and the parents will take very close care of those chicks all the way through the summer. Now they'll help them feed and learn how to feed and care for them, help them avoid predators until the fall, and then they'll migrate south. So those little tiny, you know, tiny chicks have to grow all the way to the size of being able to fly by midsummer, and then eventually to migrate in the fall around October or November, depending on the year. And so they have a lot of eating to do to grow that big. They're going to grow, you know, about 4 feet in those months, which is pretty amazing, and launch up and migrate. So, the parents are very good caretakers of the chicks and do a great job protecting them and helping them get to that state where they can fly and make it to south before the next winter. So it's a big task for them, and they'll start out eating everything they can, earthworms and any kind of grubs and things, as well as waste corn and whatever they can find out there to keep going.
So. Yeah, and you don't want to anger one of the parents. They can be pretty tough fighters.
Yeah, they are tough. You know, and your mention of them being along the road and being tough fighters and all is a good reminder. You know, the sandhills are coming into our more urban areas more and more, and you know, it's been so fun. Like for me, I live on the east side of Madison, and we've got cranes at a couple of places nearby, natural areas at Hartmeyer and Warner Park and elsewhere, and you know, it's just wonderful to have them back, but we are seeing cranes and people together in ways that, you know, we couldn't have dreamed of 30 years ago here in the state. And, you know, as the caller just said, they're along roadsides. We're actually getting some roadkill sandhill cranes happening now and then. So we have a whole new way of thinking about the birds than we did when they were, you know, still pretty rare in the state 20 or 30 years ago. And that includes sort of living side by side with these enormous birds, you know, and I've seen some amazing scenes in Madison. I've seen people out reading the newspaper in chairs with sandhills out pecking in their lawn nearby. And we've had people complain that sandhills were pecking at mirrors on the side of their windows at the side of their house, which looked like mirrors. And so it's kind of a whole new landscape for sandhills to be moving a little bit more into urban areas. And it's a new set of challenges, you know, we have to say the birds can be dangerous. You don't want to tangle with a sandhill, but also we don't want them to get so used to people that suddenly they're getting a lot more vulnerable to our dogs that may chase them down, or to, you know, getting injured from people or cars and all. So a lot to think about as they move into our more urban areas these days. Yeah.
Mark, thanks again. Connie in Portage, your turn now. Hi, Connie.
Hi. I have a question. I thought I heard quite a while back that Marquette County had the largest amount of birds in the state. Is that true?
Largest number of cranes, yeah. Is that true?
Yes.
Yeah, basically it is true that the recovery of sandhill cranes in Wisconsin sort of started heavily in that area and has kind of spread out over time. We do this event called the Crane Count every spring that's been going on for decades, and some of your listeners probably participate in that. It's a really fun event. And just by plotting each year the results of the crane count, we can see year after year how the cranes have spread out and covered, you know, pretty much all the counties of Wisconsin and now into Iowa and northern Illinois and Minnesota. And you can really see that spread just looking year to year. But a lot of it started in that area. And, you know, for us, so interesting, not far from the Crane Foundation. And to have that center of that population we've been studying so long and spread out. And, you know, who could have thought 30 years ago, you know, that we could have 10,000 sandhill cranes on the Wisconsin River, you know, just a stone's throw from where the Crane Foundation is now and where the Aldo Leopold lands are there. And it's amazing to have the birds in that area and breeding in great numbers and migrating through in such huge numbers in the fall.
Yeah, absolutely. Connie, thank you so much. Maria in Sauk County, it's your turn. Hi, Maria.
Hi, I just wanted to report a sighting of like at least, and I am not exaggerating, at least 50 cranes all together in one area. Probably they were in a field trying to scavenge for some food. This was like about a week and a half to 2 weeks ago, and it was in the later part of the day. We were driving home, driving north on Highway 23, and then we live over close to Rock Springs, and we took a turned off on Highway CH, which then would kind of doglegs and again connects back to 154. And they were just like right I could have thrown a stone in the middle of them. Just this huge group sitting there, just, you know, enjoying themselves. It looked like a big crane party.
Crane parties, Rich.
Thanks for sharing that news. And in fact, it's kind of a bachelor party because we do call those, like I said, we call those birds, most of the time those birds are not paired up yet and are kind of roaming around in flocks until they settle down and form pairs and have kids. And so we call them bachelor groups. So you could think of them as bachelor parties too, I guess. But they're all roaming around out there. I've also seen some big flocks along Highway 14 going out that way, out in those fields towards Spring Green and along the road there. And yeah, I know exactly up in the area you're talking about near Rock Springs. And it's you know, again, just to have these kind of numbers back. You know, we often talk about some of the beautiful writings, like Aldo Leopold writing Marshland Elegy about the idea of the last sandhill crane spiraling up in the sky. And, you know, 50, 70 years ago, it looked kind of that way. And here we are. You know, it's just such a wonderful success story. It's so great to have them back in our land in such big numbers. So,
Maria, you had a good sight there. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. John in Toma, we'll turn to you next. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I was interested in the whooping crane thing. I'm in Toma, and I'm close to the Nacito Wildlife Refuge, so I get to go out there and check out the whooping cranes when they're around as much as I can, and I really enjoy them. But I was wondering about that migration program where they would have the person fly in an ultralight and have all the whooping cranes for their migration down south, you know, and then back north. I was wondering if they still do that or if they're pretty much on their own now. I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
All right, John, thank you.
Okay, great question. Yeah, the whole sort of problem of bringing whooping cranes back to Wisconsin, of course, they were lost from the state about 130 years ago. So about 21 years ago, we started trying to bring the whooping crane back to Wisconsin and to the eastern U.S. with lots of partners. And a core part of that program to bring them back was teaching them their migration route, because once the cranes died out, their original migration route was lost. So those ultralight planes that you're asking about were a huge part of that program. We had to rear cranes, and then through the process of rearing them, they would imprint essentially on costumed people who would basically pretend to be whooping cranes and get them to follow these ultralight aircrafts to relearn their annual migration down south for the winter. So we did that for many, many years in partnership with Operation Migration. That was hugely successful to reteach that migration route. And we got so many birds back in the wild doing that that really migration isn't the problem anymore. The birds can migrate now annually on their own. They've learned new routes. They go south every winter. And our job has shifted more to getting new birds out to supplement those birds out in the wild, so getting more birds out each year so that we have more birds in the wild. They migrate on their own and then pair up. And I like I said before, forming new pairs is really exciting for us because that's especially what we want to see is new crane pairs forming out and then reestablishing. So we're not using the ultralight aircraft anymore. We are still putting birds back out in the wild, and those birds migrate with the wild whoopers that were reintroduced from the years in the past. And eventually we hope that all these birds going out will, like I said, become self-sustaining in the wild and able to just keep going on their own so that we don't have to put out birds at all anymore. And that's very much where we'd like to get to with that program. So, yeah, we're very grateful for everyone who was involved in that migration program, because it really was it was a fun time. People loved seeing the birds following those aircraft, and it was really successful. You know, it was a great success to get the birds back in migration after being completely lost from this half of the country. So,
where do they migrate to?
They migrate. They basically go as far south as they have to. Originally, we set up the program to get them all the way to Florida, but they never really liked going all that far, all the way down to Florida for whatever reason. And they're stopping over southern Indiana, Alabama, Tennessee, a little bit down in that area, sometimes into Florida. But they'll in some years when the winter is mild, they'll really stop, you know, sort of central southern Illinois and Indiana, and they don't go much further than that. They'll stay and spend their winter down there. We've got good numbers around Alabama, Wheeler National Wildlife Refuge, around that area. And so they're basically, their idea of winter vacation is just going as far as they need to get good food and not be buried in snowstorms and get good food. And so that's where they end up most winters. Yeah.
Bob in Amherst Junction, it's your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi. So a farmer had told me that the cranes will get on a cornfield just as the corn's coming up and walk down the row, and a couple of cranes will pick up every one of those little seedlings and eat all the corn seedlings in a row of corn. That's the number one question is, do you think that's true? And the second question is, if they did that, wouldn't they get a huge load of fungicide because all those corn seeds are soaked in fungicide before they're planted?
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Great questions. The issue of the cranes going down the row crops there when they're planted, that definitely can happen. And one of the big programs we've been working on for about the last 20 years is to try and come up with alternatives to keep the birds from plucking those new corn seedlings. So we worked with a company to develop a product that's out now called Avapel that's really about, it's a bad taste, it's not toxic at all, but it's a bad tasting coating that you put on seed so that when it's planted out in the farms, the cranes don't eat it. It also keeps blackbirds and turkeys and other things from eating the seed. And so we were trying to come out with a solution because we know if the farmer comes out and just chases away the birds from their farm, they're most likely to just fly over to some other farm and start feeding as well. So we thought what we want to do is keep the cranes on the farm but have them eat other stuff like waste grain and grubs and any other insects that they can find. So we came up with that product, and we've been just trying to push it out as much as we can to get it out on more farms so that so they don't eat those fresh seedlings that come up. Cranes will pretty much eat anything, and those fresh seedlings are very tasty, so we're trying to get them off of that. So that's our main way of trying to deal with that, kind of deal with it on the farm rather than passing along the problem to another farm. And the product was registered not too long ago with the EPA, and trying to open the doors to getting it out on farms throughout the Midwest. As far as the fungicide goes, that's an area we don't know very well. As I mentioned, the coating that we are trying to get out to prevent cranes from eating the new seedlings is definitely non-toxic, but some of the other chemicals cranes may eat on farms could be toxic to them. And we've had, not here in Wisconsin, but overseas in Asia and all, we've had very serious problems with poisoning of cranes on crops. Sometimes that's just from contact with pesticides, and sometimes it's farmers will put out poisons because they're worried about birds eating their crops, and so they'll deliberately put out pesticides to try and kill or distract other birds from feeding on farms. So that definitely can be an issue, and something that we're certainly concerned about and would want to hear about any reports of the cranes getting any noticeable effects of eating chemicals that are on some of the corn out there. So it's certainly of concern, but we don't know specifically of any cases in Wisconsin where that was a problem.
Marilyn emailed, she's 70 years old, grew up on a farm north of Madison, never even heard of cranes until she was in her 30s. Now she sees them everywhere. To what do you credit the wonderful recovery?
Yes. Well, I share in that wonder. I moved to Wisconsin about 35 years ago, and I didn't see a crane for years when I first moved here. And So it's really been remarkable. There's lots of reasons for that. The number one is wetland conservation. You know, you heard from my wife Katie last hour and all the work Wisconsin Wetlands and so many organizations, ourselves included, trying to protect wetlands and raise awareness about how important they are. You've got to have the habitat out there, and we really credit farmers because so many of those wetlands are on farms out there that the cranes are using. And so that was one. And the other was regulations on hunting the birds. They were hunted very heavily about 100 years ago. Both whoopers and sandhills took a very hard hit from hunting back then. And so it was the combination of those two things, really reducing the direct loss of the bird and having enough habitat for them on the landscape. And then I think the one other thing for the sandhills is they really switched over to adapting very well to the farmed landscape. They used to be in prairies, and now
they're everywhere.
They really prefer cornfields. There's so much to eat on those cornfields, and most of what they eat are little grubs and waste grain and all kinds of stuff. So as I said before, if we can keep them from eating those fresh shoots, we think their overall benefit on the farms is quite good. So
there we go. Rich, thank you. Rich from the International Crane Foundation, Rich Belfast. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.